Before you think that's a great thing to do, when I heard London broil, I said, that's all I need. When my wife feeds me, she has to serve it in full catcher's gear or she might lose a finger, so. Well, good morning. As Bob mentioned, my name is John Horrigan. And it's a pleasure to be here at Worcester Polytech Institute for the Tech Old Timers. I'm honored to be the guest speaker at your 50th anniversary year. Such a great organization. Today's talk is about the Worcester Tornado, and I put your baseball team's logo up there in the corner. As Bob mentioned, I'm an old New England folklorist. I've been called many things. Some are rude monikers that will not be mentioned in public, but historical raconteur, a rogue nostalgian, an infotainer born from Google Books and PowerPoint. I pushed an agenda known as the New Popular Public History. I bring a contemporary and invigorating view to American history. My website is www.ushistory.me. As my grandfather told me, the best medicine you can give a senior is to try to take him or her back to their childhood, and that's what my agenda is. As Bob mentioned, I'm an expert on New England historical weather. I love historical fires, historical astronomy, historical economics, Irish history, Rev War, unexplained mysteries, etc. I belong to a number of historical societies, my hometown in Watertown, Mass., member of the Lincoln Minutemen, and also I belong to the Economic History Association, the Economic Historical Society, and my favorite, the Society in Dedham for the Apprehension of Horse Thieves. Any rustlers, you let me know, okay? And if I break out into a hockey announcer's voice, I apologize in advance. I'm an announcer with the Boston Bruins alumni. My beloved Bruins are taking on those vaunted, chippy Philadelphia Flyers tonight in Game 3. And also, I'm the New England Patriots, I'm the New England Patriots basketball announcer, believe it or not. That's another story on another day. And in fact, I'm in Woburn tonight at 7 o'clock with Kevin Falk and some of the guys. I also organize the New England History Festival, www.historyfestival.org. I call it Historapalooza. It's coming to Watertown on November 13th. My moniker is The Past is a Blast. My axiom, and it certainly applies here today, is there's always someone in attendance who knows more about the subject than I do, and of course someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. It's the former as opposed to the latter today. I'm going to be giving you a historical, national, broad overview of the Worcester Tornado, and I can't wait to hear your personal recollections, even if it's a blowing leaf. I want to hear about it today, so please enlighten me. I'll be learning from you, and it's great to be here in Worcester. Again, I'd love to hear your personal recollections, and I ask that you hold your questions until the end of my presentation today. And we're going to look at great twisters of the old Bay State, an anatomy of a tornado and the Fujita scale, the tornado outbreak of June 1953, the Worcester tornado, the little brothers, as I call them, and a photographic montage and vigil. The images will say it all, and I won't be speaking much when we look at the aftermath. And then we'll go over some factoids. I don't think we'll have time this morning for great New England tornadoes, but we'll see. Well, the first tornado ever recorded, and it's debatable, in Anglo-Saxon North American history was July 15, 1643. That's the new style Gregorian calendar. And four-term governor John Winthrop, who served from 1630 to 1649. This is known as America's first recorded tornado by an Anglo-Saxon. But the honor may go to Sir Francis Drake, who reported waterspouts off the North Carolina coast in 1586 and 1590. You see in his logs great spouts. I won't go off on Sir Francis Drake, but I'm not a big fan of his today. Incidentally, I'll be driving the text off of the screen, so if you can't read the text, don't worry. Trust me, they'll be able to hear me in Millbury today. Yeah, there's Francis Drake. I somehow think that this man is involved in the lost colony of Roanoke, but that's another lecture on another day. So this is according to Winthrop. Quote, there arose a sudden gust at northwest, so violent for half an hour, as it blew down multitudes of trees. It lifted up their meeting house at Newbury, the people being in it. It darkened the air with dust, yet through God's great mercy, it did no hurt, but only killed one Indian with the fall of a tree. So nobody died except for an Indian. It was so straight between Lynn and Hampton. Now, where you were dealt a severe tornado in 1953 that came from the west of Massachusetts, I have to let you know that 100 years before that, you dealt a tornado to eastern Massachusetts in Worcester. August 22nd, 1851, this is a tornado that I've studied extensively over the past 5 years. It's the last great tornado of eastern Massachusetts, and it was most likely an F3. And for all intent and purpose, eastern Massachusetts ceased being a leading cider producer due to the number of prime apple orchards that were destroyed by the Great Middlesex Tornado. The tornado began in Worcester, in Quinsigamond. It went to Wayland, Weston, Waltham, Belmont, West Cambridge, which is modern-day Arlington, Medford, Malden, Lynn, Swampscott, Rockport, and it blew out to sea. This is the path that it took, and I'll be using a laser today, but it basically started out here and moved in a north-northeast direction. There are some great stories, and I just want to enlighten you before we get into the Worcester tornado here. The foremost researcher of this twister was William Blasius, who was fishing at Fresh Pond a few minutes before the tornado passed only a few hundred yards to the north of that small body of water. But he had taken shelter from the approaching thundercloud and did not actually witness the event, much to his chagrin. His lecture in Concord in February of 1852 was attended by Henry David Thoreau. Thoreau, a transcendentalist, a naturalist, for all intent and purpose, a rock star in the early 19th century, middle 19th century. Quote, Thoreau says, "The audience are never tired of hearing how far the wind carried some man, woman, or child, or family Bible, but they are immediately tired if you undertake to give them a scientific account of it." So I hope not to tire you today. And of course, they say that there was a water spout on Spy Pond. And as the vortex crossed Spy Pond, a column of water more than 100 feet high, mixed with dust from the roadway and gravel from the railroad embankment, was raised from the surface, and two ice houses on the shore were demolished. In one of the ice houses was a man with a horse and a carriage. As the storm began, the horse panicked and started out of the building, dragging the man. As it did, the carriage was crushed by falling timbers. The horse and the man were uninjured. And finally, mudslinging. Colonel Douglas of Cambridgeport, who was sailing on the pond with two friends, had his boat lifted into the air perpendicularly by the waterspout, but saved his life by clinging to a tree on the nearby shore. I can find no other account of his two other friends. William Blasius said, "Everything in the vicinity, including several boys playing on the shore, were plastered in water and a gravelly mud. The boys, uninjured, in their fleeting elation, asked if it might happen again just one more time." Of course, Spy Pond was used for ice harvests in the middle of the 19th century. And then Millard goes a-sailing. Millard Fillmore. Fillmore is the 13th president. In a small room just 4 rods south of Medford Center was an engraved likeness of President Fillmore, pasted strongly upon a rough plastered wall. Around it were many other engravings of like size. The room was so situated that the wind came in at a west door and went out at an east window. The 13th president's portrait was taken from a wall without tearing it or soiling it in the least and carried through an open window and transported more than a quarter of a mile. It was deposited in the garden of a friend who returned it safely to be again fastened in its place. And here are some famous depictions of that tornado at Medford. This is in Gleason's Pictorial, September 13th, 1851. You can see the darkness and the trees swaying. And then again, this is called the Horrors of the Whirlwind Throughout New England. And of course, you'll see these different PowerPoint manipulations where I spin it around. Another great twister hit Arlington on August 28th, 1871, at Sunday night at 10:50 p.m. And one of my favorites I've studied is the Great Martha's Vineyard waterspout that hit on August 19, 1896. It formed from a thunderstorm on the junction of Vineyard and Nantucket Sounds. It moved from Oak Bluffs towards Vineyard Haven. It was a funnel cloud formed and dissolved 3 times, though an invisible vortex still raised spray. The funnel cloud was largest on its second appearance when it was vertical, and the pillar was 3,600 feet high. The spray rose to 420 feet. Now, what's a tornado? And I promise I will not get any more technical after we go through this on the Fujita scale. A violent rotating column of air which is in contact with both the surface of the earth and a cumulonimbus cloud, or, in rare cases, the base of a cumulus cloud. The most intense of all atmospheric phenomena, tornadoes come in many shapes and sizes, but are typically in the form of a visible condensation funnel whose narrow end touches the earth and is often encircled by a cloud of debris and dust. And that's just a scientific manipulation of what a tornado would be and how it would lift particles. And you'll see how that comes into play when we talk about the Worcester tornado. On average, the United States experiences 100,000 thunderstorms each year, and approximately 1,000 tornadoes develop from these storms. Over 80% of tornadoes strike between noon and midnight. On average, a tornado will stay on the ground for no more than 20 minutes. The Fujita scale, or F scale, or Fujita-Pearson scale, is a scale for rating tornado intensity based on the damage tornadoes inflict on human-built structures and vegetation. The scale was introduced in 1971 by Ted Fujita of the University of Chicago, along with Alan Pearson. Pearson brought in the path length and the width additions in 1973, and Pearson was the head of the National Severe Storms Forecast Center, which was a predecessor to the Storm Prediction Center in Kansas City, Missouri. And there's Ted, and we're going to give the Tedster a little spin here. Here we go. The official Fujita scale category is determined by meteorologists and engineers after ground and or aerial damage survey and depending on the circumstances, ground swirl patterns, cycloidal marks, radar tracking, eyewitness testimonies, media reports, and damage imagery, as well as available video. And this has been modified. The original Fujita scale had an F0 at 40 to 70 miles per hour, and I think we've had like, what, five F0s since January in New England alone with these nor'easters that are clobbering us. And then you go up to an indescribable F6, which is 319 miles per hour, Mach 1, or the speed of sound. And basically, you've all heard this new term that's come to light in the last decade or so, microburst. And we witness them in May, June, and July, and sometimes August. And that's when you have chimney damage, tree branches broken. At F1, you start to see mobile homes pushed off of their foundations, and then you move up the scale to an F4, which is where well-constructed walls are leveled. And of course, the danger for tornadoes is flying debris. Then came the enhanced Fujita scale. Tom Grzulis of the Tornado Project grew up in Vermont, wrote a book. If you go on eBay or Amazon.com called Significant Tornadoes, I can't afford it. I saw $657 for a book out of print. Well, he rated all known significant tornadoes in the United States dating back to 1880. And it was previously used in most areas outside of Great Britain, and it was superseded in 2007 by the enhanced Fujita scale in the United States of America. The enhanced Fujita scale then made an EF0 of 65 miles per hour to 85 miles per hour, with an EF1 of 86 to 110, an EF4 of 166 to 200, and an EF5. And you're going to see where the Worcester tornado, I'll mention it later, where it was originally assessed as an F5 and then downgraded in 2004 to an F4. The peak months for tornado formation in the Northeast are June through August, with the most tornadoes forming in August. In the Northeast, the area from Albany, New York, through central Massachusetts and into southern New Hampshire is at the most risk for tornadoes. There are three stages. We're not going to go over it. You have stage one with high velocity winds that blow windward. And then you have the vacuum cap, where you have an inconceivable drop in pressure. And then finally, the back wall, stage three. That's the back end of the tornado. We're going to be looking at some hook echoes today. And a hook echo is a radar return. I call a severe thunderstorm with a very bad temper, but hook echoes, you can see here, okay? And we're going to be looking at some of these radar returns. It's amazing now that growing up with my dad at 6:13 every evening, I used to hear, shh, the weather. And as New England people, we know that it's very important, but now I can look at the Doppler and I could mow my lawn up until 5 minutes before the thunderstorm comes, because I can see street by street when the storm moves eastward. Amazing. If you look at tornado activity in the United States, you see Tornado Alley, of course, in the Midwest and central of the United States, and you see how the Boston area and Massachusetts is prone to tornado. And if you take a more global look at it, of course, the United States is prone to tornado, but as is Eastern Europe, South Africa, and of course Australia, and portions of South America, and China, dust storms. Deadliest tornadoes in history was the Tri-State tornado of March 18, 1925, 695 deaths. And then May 6, 1840, Natchez, Mississippi, 317 deaths. St. Louis also had a severe one in 1896. Okay, let's get into the tornado now, the ramp up. The early days of June 1953 found central Massachusetts experiencing several days of early summer heat, reaching 90 degrees Fahrenheit on the 6th of June, but the 7th and 8th of June were pleasant with a high of only 76 degrees. On Monday, June 8th, a much cooler air mass entered into the upper Great Lakes from central Canada. The ensuing clash between warm, moist Gulf of Mexico air and cool, dry Canadian air sparked powerful thunderstorms over Michigan and the Ohio Valley. Flint, Michigan reached 83 degrees Fahrenheit in the warm sector before the cold front moved in. Along the frontal zone, an outbreak of 10 significant, that's F2 or stronger, tornadoes touched down, including a pair in northern Ohio that claimed 35 lives between them. And of course, the Beecher tornado happened the same day. And this is a photograph in Flint, Michigan. The worst death and destruction visited Flint, Michigan area at about 8:30 p.m. Central Daylight Time when an F5 monster killed 116 citizens, the last individual tornado to inflict more than 100 deaths in the United States. And you can see some of the paths.
They had several outbreaks that day.
The low pressure system and cold front responsible for the severe thunderstorms in Michigan and Ohio moved to New Hampshire and central Massachusetts overnight. It's coming this way. As the Worcester Gazette headlined the news of the deadly Flint tornado in its June 9th morning edition, the storm system approached New England. By early Tuesday afternoon, June 9th, towering cumulonimbus clouds appeared over east central New York, setting the stage for the severe weather to come. The official forecast for central Massachusetts called for a continuation of hot, humid weather with the likelihood of afternoon thunderstorms, some possibly severe. And this is actually from the Weather Bureau. At 12:30 p.m., that's 1:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time, several large towering cumulonimbus cloud formations were noted just north of the laboratory. Their vertical growth was so rapid as to resemble the effects observed with time-lapse motion pictures of large cumulus clouds. At this time, a counterclockwise motion was observed within the cloud mass, which at that time consisted of 8 or 10 separate towers. This effect, together with the presence of dry air aloft, as evidenced by the rapid shredding of the cumulus towers around the edge of the cloud mass, led us to remark that conditions were suitable for tornado formation. Of course, this is the after-action review. So this is the area where we think that the tornadoes began developing in upstate New York, near Mechanicsville and Saratoga Springs. So here is the appearance of the Worcester Tornado Supercell from the GE Laboratories in Schenectady, New York, over 90 miles away from where I stand this morning. And you can just see the formation beginning. Another series. And still another series of photos. The birth of a monster. The U.S. Weather Bureau storm forecasters believe that there was the potential for tornadoes in New York and New England that afternoon and evening. The Buffalo, New York office warned Western New York residents of the possibility for a tornado, but the official forecast released from the Boston office did not mention the threat, based in part on the rarity of Massachusetts tornadoes and perhaps partly on the potential psychological impact on those residing in the area. And I liken this, one of the talks that I give is the Great Hurricane of 1938. A lot of you are way too young here. You weren't around in 1938. So, that was also where a young meteorologist on September 21st, 1938, by the name of Charlie Pierce, substituting for a vacation meteorologist in Washington, said, there's going to be a hurricane that's going to race up the Atlantic seaboard. And he was talked down by a senior meteorologist who said, in my lifetime, there's never been a hurricane that hit New York or New England. There never will be. So people were never warned, and that's why they were never prepared. And the same setup is happening here with the Worcester tornado. Tornado forecasting for public warnings was only in its first full year of implementation. How ironic is that? And some resulting in panic in other regions of the country. You know, you hear about it with the National Hurricane Center. They predict so many hurricanes per year, and people don't heed the warnings. And we saw what happened with Hurricane Katrina and other hurricanes. And whenever I hear the National Weather Service issue warnings or watches, I always heed them. So warnings had been broadcast in Ohio and Michigan the previous day, and they were correct. As the convective storm complex surged eastward, it continued to build. And the monster cometh. The tornado that we refer to as the Worcester tornado moved across Worcester County for 46 miles during an 84-minute lifetime. The funnel formed over the northern reaches of the Quabbin Reservoir before touching down in heavily forested areas south of the town of Petersham at 4:25 p.m. This is the path of the Worcester tornado, moving to the southeast. Petersham, Barrie, Oakham and Rutland, Holden, northern Worcester, and some parts of West Boylston, Shrewsbury, Northboro, Westboro, and a slight portion of Southboro, and we're going to look at that in a moment. Again, if you look at the mark where it touched down and where it moved in central Massachusetts. Touchdown. Plowing across a farm field, the funnel tore a 200-year-old 4-foot diameter tree out from its roots. Moving southeastward at 35 miles per hour towards the community of Barrie, it claimed its first victims, Beverly Strong, age 18, and Edward White, age 11. Okay, now let's look at the echoes. As I mentioned about the hook echo,
Worcester, and then the storm developing.
It's an isolated severe formation. In Lexington, Mass., these radar images from MIT's Project Lincoln, I don't like to say MIT when I'm at Worcester Polytech, so I apologize in advance, but we all know this is a better undergraduate program, right? It showed the tornado's hook echo at 4:55, 4:56, and 4:58 p.m. when the storm was in Holden. So when they first got these images, there was no time to react and get the warning out. This is the first hook echo that was ever observed was in April of the same year in Illinois. So the Worcester tornado's hook echo was the fourth ever recorded. And look at that. Yeah. Again, I'll go through these series here. You can see it developing, but that's nasty. And again, we're looking right here. So, there was discussion as to issuing an advisory about a forthcoming tornado. So, New England's first ever severe thunderstorm forecast was issued at 11:30 a.m. on a historic Tuesday, June 9th, 1953. Incoming. It was described by an eyewitness as a huge cone of black smoke. The tornado continued toward the 200,000 residents of the city of Worcester. On its way, its deadly finger of destruction touched Rutland, where 2 were killed, and Holden, where 9 were killed, before moving into northern Worcester City. And here you see the tornado touches down west of Worcester in this photo by the late Reader Caney of Rutland. And a girl on the staff of the Veterans Administration Hospital at Rutland, who was looking out of a fourth-story laboratory window when the tornado passed, later described what she saw. It got very dark shortly after 4 o'clock, she said. Wind came up and lightning. At about 4:45, I noticed that the clouds were blowing southwest and that the trees were bent in the opposite direction. Suddenly, the clouds lifted in the west and it became quite light. Then a huge black cloud, like smoke, came directly out of the northwest, boiling furiously. I could see little wisps of clouds being whipped away from the big cloud, which was shaped like a cone. Then came hail and driving rain, which lasted only a minute or so. After the hail, I could see the cloud traveling away southeast like a big cloud of smoke moving very rapidly. Then the sun came out. This is the first known photograph of a tornado in New England. It was taken in Rutland, Mass., mile 20 at 4:49 p.m., looking towards the south-southwest, looking across fields near Main Street, which is modern-day Route 122A, east of Rutland Center. 4:49 p.m., again, a view from some distance away of the tornado approaching. And here's a picture of a hailstone that fell during the tornado, and it's compared with a light bulb. Light bulb on the right. Holden, Mass., 4:57 p.m., one of the most famous photographs of the Worcester tornado, taken by Stanley Smith. And it was probably in the vicinity of Reservoir Street or Route 31 near Holden Center. And it approaches the first built-up neighborhood. And this is where civilization is going to get it. Worcester gets scoured. At 5:08 p.m., a local reporter saw, quote, a dark, ominous twister carrying with it boards and debris and raising clouds of dust. The tornado sliced a path a mile wide through the city's north side, destroying a residential area, Assumption College, and a new housing development, and severely damaging the newly completed Norton Company plant. And I might tell you, there's so many individual stories that I've researched, I can't possibly tell them all here today, but I'm kind of yielding to you folks to hear your own personal recollections. So, in the fateful minute that it passed through town, 1 minute, 60 residents died. Continuing its deadly tramp eastward, the tornado slashed through Shrewsbury, where 12 were killed, Westboro, where 6 were killed, and on to Southboro, where 3 were killed. The intensity of the storm, whose winds were estimated at 250 miles per hour, can be viewed from its debris field, which extended as far as 50 miles away, and we'll be looking at it in a moment. About your fair city of Worcester. In 1953, the state's second largest city, with a population of about 200,000 citizens. Winds that may have been the highest ever seen, certainly the highest ever in New England, sucked the water out of ponds and annihilated buildings, picking them up and sending them everywhere at once. Chickens had their feathers torn off. The paint was removed from cars by the incredible power of the air, and one man actually had his chest explode due to the pressure from his expanding lungs. I think it dropped 2 pounds per inch is the final tally. At 5:08, the tornado reached Worcester, where the force of its winds picked up manhole covers off the streets and rolled them away like frisbees. A 12-ton bus was picked up, rolled over several times, and then thrown through an apartment building, killing 2 passengers. A priest and 2 nuns at Assumption College perished in the Worcester tornado, as did 6 workers at the Brookside Home Farm, along with most of the 80 cows located there. Just an anecdote back to the hurricane of 1938. A man who had chickens, had just banded his chickens on September 20th, 1938. The next day after the hurricane passed, one of his chickens that he raised in Long Island was found in Connecticut. Well, the roof was blown off of the city's largest employer, the Norton Company, which had just completed their new $6 million factory. This is Lucien Desjardins, a professor at Assumption College, and recalls what it was like inside the building at 0 hour when the tornado hit. And I'll quote, I'll drive the narrative here. A little after 5, there was what I took to be a typical New England thunderstorm going on with a little hail. We stood on the steps of the gym, and I said to my son, see how a thunderstorm forms. Look at the updrafts in that cloud. It was very dark inside the building, and I could hear the wind roaring, and I stumbled over the objects once or twice. It was that dark. Then I looked out and saw the limbs of trees blowing around, and they were going from left to right, north. I said, let's duck. And the 4 of us got down to the floor of the vestibule, and I kept thinking, the trees are flying north. I can't explain why. But that was the thought that kept running through my head. The trees are flying north. It seemed very profound and important at that time. Then when it was over and the sky cleared in the west, There had been so much noise and commotion that none of us knew that the tower had crashed and those poor people had been killed. I said to the boy, that was a tornado.
Worcester, Mass., 5:08 p.m. The view towards the north, the tornado had just entered Worcester near Brattle Street and increases in intensity, and the width grows as it bears down on Greendale. I lived for 6 months in the early 90s on View Street. Mile 35, Shrewsbury, 5:22 p.m. The view towards the north-northeast, and this photo was taken from 53 Well Street in Worcester, showing the mile-wide funnel as it looked from 3 miles away. A classic supercell structure. Mile 38, Shrewsbury, 5:26 p.m. The view towards the west-southwest, the mile-wide vortex as it's seen from the junction of routes 9 and 20. I think we all know where that is. Shrewsbury, 2 minutes later, 5:28 p.m. The view towards the south-southwest. Ominous skies block out the afternoon sun as deadly funnel approaches the southwest cutoff, Route 20, near South Street. This is the last known photograph of the tornado on the ground. Now, there were three New England tornadoes that day. By mid-afternoon, three tornadoes touched down over New England. The killer in Worcester County, and the second further northeast in Rockingham County, New Hampshire, which destroyed 15 homes and businesses and injured 15, and the third to the southeast of the Worcester tornado in the Massachusetts counties of Norfolk and Bristol, where it injured 17 and caused $700,000 in damage, 1953 dollars. The dollar's so worthless I can't do the factor of what it would be in 2010, but... We live in strange days indeed, given oil slicks and volcanoes going off and Heather Locklear driving again. It's Let's just examine this. So we see the Worcester tornado, and then you see the younger one beginning in Sutton, called the Sutton-Wrentham tornado. And this is about an hour later. I call this the Southborough Swirl. The reason is my cousin Lucy, who's always sending me anecdotal evidence about the tornado, she found a passage from a book entitled Fences of Stone, which was the town history of Southborough, written by Richard Noble in 1990. And she's been searching, following up on a yarn that claimed that the tornado had actually split in two and went around the Pilgrim Church in Southborough. And there were little miracles that happened. Houses totally destroyed. People just vacated an area where the tornado struck. Glass being blown in, and people have just vacated the area. And I call it Providence, and I saw a lot of these tales show up in the hurricane in 1938, and I'm sure that you're going to tell me some when we conclude here in just a few minutes. Well, the twister passed just south of Route 9 and hit Parkerville, Middle, Mount Vickery, Woodland, Corderville, and Breakneck Hill Roads in Southborough. At the post office, in a section known as Fayville, in the ground floor of his home, Postmaster James J. Trioli heard a terrible noise, and you're going to tell me it sounded like a whole bunch of trains, and they thought it was a hurricane. Well, he sent his family down to the cellar, but as he started down the basement stairs, the tornado struck the house, and the building began to tear apart. His wife started up to help him, but the staircase collapsed, and she was killed. And then the house fell in. In another Fayville home, a man was crushed under his refrigerator as his walls came down. The cyclone then roared up Breakneck Hill. Mr. and Mrs. Ray Davis were having a meeting in the big house at Davco Farm when huge hailstones started falling from the sky. One of the underrated things about this tornado is the great fire that we'll talk about in just a moment, and also the fusillade of hailstones that took place. They tend to talk about the wind. Ray Davis had the presence of mind to reach for his motion picture camera, even as the incredible winds tore through the Davco properties, ripping up orchards, leveling 13 of the 14 Davco buildings, and leaving the 60 tractors warehoused there in a tangled, twisted heap. Ray Davis's film, the only record of the storm's devastation, showed the Davco barn literally exploding. I can't find this. Anybody here knows where this film is or can direct me to it? Love to find out. James Trioli was pulled from the wreckage of the Fayetteville post office alive, but he would die 7 years later from the injuries that he received that day. In Framingham, a young man, Dick Curran, found mail from the Fayetteville post office blown there by the powerful winds. And within minutes of the tornado's passing, the sky cleared to a bright blue sky with big, white, puffy thunderclouds banked up to the east. This is the end of the tornado. And here's the tornado cloud about a half hour after it went by. You can see the towering thunderheads. Blue hills, black sky. Debris started raining on the Blue Hill Meteorological Observatory, 30 miles east of Worcester, and the staff notified the Boston Weather Bureau, which was immediately issuing a severe thunderstorm and tornado warning for the area west of Boston. Watch meaning possibility, warning meaning it's coming. Debris fell on Blue Hill for 30 minutes. First oak twigs with frayed leaves, then papers. And they often say that in Canton and Milton, there are seedlings that came from Worcester trees. So if you look at some of the trees there, actually, their predecessors are in Worcester. Rags, wood splinters, shingles, roofing paper, insulation, 6-foot clapboard planks, and 10-foot square pieces of roofing or walls. The director of the observatory, Charles Brooks, reportedly found a French music box, pages of the Worcester Telegram and Worcester Gazette, an aluminum trap door, a piece of roof, and a frozen couch cover on the grounds. Debris was also found in Massachusetts Bay near Weymouth and out in the Atlantic Ocean. Chunks of soggy, frozen mattress fell into the Boston Harbor from Worcester. This is just a letter Shelley Potter wrote to Charles Brooks about the account that was endured. And basically, Shelley states, at approximately 16:15 hours, that's 4:15, rain started to fall, and by 4:20, it had become a downpour with scattering of small egg-shaped hailstones. Goes in to describe how big the hailstones were, and by 4:35, the rear of the tornado could be plainly heard at the forest. It's an intense account. Now, here's an anecdote I was told as a child about the Worcester tornado. Can't find any information on it, but basically it goes like this. My grandfather told me about this. A farmer in Framingham is atop his tractor, slowly tilling his field. As he looks towards his farmhouse, he sees his wife frantically waving her arms. He waves back, thinking that she's indicating that dinner's ready, and nonchalantly goes back to his business of plowing his fields. As he turns his tractor around, he sees a dark funnel cloud approaching from the west. He shifts into high gear and heads for the house, just as the wind begins to whip violently. He's now in a race with the twister, except that his speed tops out at 20 miles per hour. Just as he gets to the house, he dives for the bulkhead, where his wife has already retreated. 20 minutes later, when he emerges from the bunker, he finds his tractor on its side 100 yards away from where he left it, and some of his fence is found a half mile away. Now, this is the man with the goldfish. This was told to me last year when I read for the Worcester Low Vision Group, and if you're here today, please speak up and tell me this story. And again, it's anecdotal. A man walked down a street in Worcester immediately after the tornado passed, holding a goldfish in a bowl. He was cut and dazed and naked from the waist down. The younger brother, known as the Sutton-Wrentham tornado, same day, an hour later, 5:30 p.m., an F3 tornado began east of West Milbury. It moved southeast to Foxborough, 28 miles through Worcester, Norfolk, and Bristol counties. And again, as we pointed out, the little brother, known as the Exeter tornado, 5:20 p.m., an F3 touches down southwest of Exeter, New Hampshire. It travels a mile and a half through Rockingham County. And then what I call the baby brother, people forget about this one. At 6 o'clock, an F1 touched down west of South Berwick, Maine, in Stratford County, and traveled for about a mile. So you actually had four tornadoes that day. Factoids. Worcester tornado, 94 people died. almost 1,288 injured. That number fluctuates. $50 million worth of damage. That's 1953 dollars. Some wind gusts are measured at over 300 miles per hour. The tornado season of 1953 was one of the worst on record in the American storm annals. For days, newspaper articles highlighted instances of people in places like Wellesley, Quincy, Dover, Needham, and Weymouth finding letters and checks addressed to residents of Worcester and vicinity. Just looking at the death toll, Worcester had 62 dead, 327 major injuries, $32 million worth of damage. Next came Holden, 10 dead, 36 major injuries. Then you have Shrewsbury with 6, Westboro 5, Southboro 5. And then the Exeter tornado caused a minor injury to 5 people, $100,000 worth of damage. And as I mentioned, the Sutton-Wrentham tornado, minor injuries to 15 with damages near $700,000. Two of the 10 deadliest U.S. tornadoes struck that year in Waco, Texas, 119 deaths, and in Flint, Michigan, 115 deaths. Both were later rated as F5 storms. The Worcester storm, originally an F5, was downgraded to an F4 in 2004 by the National Weather Service. It ranked 19th all-time with top gusts estimated at 317 miles per hour. I still argue that this is an F5. Kind of like how Pluto got downgraded to a planetoid. June contributed 111 tornadoes and 244 deaths to that figure. No year since 1953 has been as deadly. In total, 1953 reported 422 tornadoes, resulting in 519 deaths. From 1950 to 1996, New England states have documented 395 tornadoes, with Massachusetts the most tornado struck of these states, reporting 134 tornadoes, averaging just under 3 per year. In contrast, Iowa reported 1,180 tornadoes over that period. This just shows you the front moving in to the east at 2:30, 5:30, and by 8:30 it was gone. I call this the Worcester A-bomb. The fear of an attack from communist powers was rampant during the early 1950s, and people had been told what to do in case of such an event. Everyone found the nearest shelter, whether it was their basement or their closet, and waited as the Worcester tornado passed. I never realized why my father, who worked as a defense intelligence operative, I can say that he's retired, and he was infatuated with having the station wagon full of gas at all times, and now I know. Eyewitnesses watching the Worcester tornado at first thought that it was being circled by a huge flock of birds until they saw that it was actually trees, lumber, and even telephone poles that had been carried up into the sky by the howling winds. The damage the Worcester tornado caused was so severe that many residents at the height of the Cold War thought that the Russians had dropped an atomic bomb. Congress would actually debate in the weeks after the Worcester tornado if the atomic bomb testing that had been occurring in the upper atmosphere was responsible for this and other related monster twisters that ravaged the United States during 1953. Now we're going to go through these photos, courtesy of Mr. William Chittick, Mr. Richmond. I'll just present a visual here, not say much. Great Brook Valley. Look at that plank right through the side of a house. Assumption. You think B-17s dropped a raid there. Two nuns and a priest died. Do I say this right? Uncatina Avenue off of Clark and Assumption, Clark Street and Assumption College. Holden. Chevy Chase Road. It had been picked as Sawyer's House of the Year and publicized in Better Homes and Gardens magazine neighborhood. Kids from Brattle Street used to play in the old ruins for many years afterwards. Southboro. West Main Street near the center of Westboro in Barry, where two people died. First two. Bus upside down. At first glance, you might think that's the Fung Wah bus bringing it in from New York City on the Pike at 90 miles per hour, but sorry. Assumption. John F. Kennedy, just a senator, reviewed the rubble and damage in Shrewsbury. Vernon Drug, inconceivable. Looks like a flood. Laundry truck. Earthquake. I mean, you look at these pictures, you think earthquake or flood? No, tornado. What do I do now? I had no insurance. Where do I live? City Hospital, they describe as inconceivable. One veteran said it looked like a field station. He likened it to the Battle of the Bulge of the German artillery barrage. Assumption. It's the bus that killed two people, slammed into an apartment building. Colonial Way in Holden. The baby swept from the mother's arms and she found there, alive, 100 yards away. Curtis Apartments, Great Brook Valley. West Boylston. Look like he's throwing a split finger or a cutter there. I mean, look at the size of that thing. A man told me he had saved one of those in his Frigidaire for something like 13 years. Northbridge. Rutland. Shrewsbury. And then the Great Worcester Tornado Fire, ironically on Burncoat Street. First sign of smoke. A house on Eunice Avenue. With downed electrical wires, fire hazard. As if to compound the misery along Burncoat Street, fires on Francis Street. Two three-deckers ablaze on Francis Street. This was a conflagration, again, forgotten in the Worcester tornado. A three-decker collapses, another still burning. Of course, the wind still whipping the embers, blowing them to the next building. In those days, the building codes were not as refined as they are today. The raging torrents. Finally, they get some water from the bottom of the hill after about an hour. No water pressure. That's what plagued a fire in Brant Rock, Massachusetts on April 21st, 1941 that burned 600 structures and changed the complexion of Marshfield, Mass. Low water pressure. And then the National Guard shows up. I saw the National Guard the other day in Watertown. I live near the Watertown DPW. Apparently, people don't know how to boil water because there were people waiting 3 hours with their families in their car for a case of water. Am I missing something? National Guard arriving. The Norton Company. All the metal sheeting was gone from the sides and the roof. Cars blown out of the Norton Company parking lot. Burncoat Street. Holmes Ice Cream Place. Anybody ever go there?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. In a ranking of the probability of any point within the state being struck by a tornado, Massachusetts ranks 21st of all the 50 states, although central Massachusetts, where Worcester is located, is a relative tornado alley for locations east of the Appalachian Mountains. Methinks that Worcester will get hit with another tornado at some point in the future due to the topography. Those are my sources. That's my talk. You've been a great audience. Thank you. And now my turn. All right, put them up. Who's got a great story of the Worcester tornado, even just an anecdote or recollection? I'd love to hear it. Yes?
I actually have two. I was singing in the Worcester Music Festival chorus, and we rehearsed in Mechanics Hall, which wasn't nearly as nice as it is today. But going in, I thought, the air is strange. It was so quiet. We never heard the tornado. When we came out, it was all over. And the second story is, my dad was very active in Boy Scouts, and I can remember the Boy Scout troops from all over Worcester providing tents for people to live in after the tornado.
A different age,
yeah.
Where brother helped brother and sister helped sister.
Yeah.
Amazing. Just before I went on, I got an email, I'll go to you just in a second, from a long friend. I grew up in Dedham, Massachusetts, live in Watertown now, and she says that was it, described almost the way you did it. It was a strange day. The term green day happens in the Midwest, where it's a precursor to a tornado. But she says in Dedham, debris was falling from the sky. Yes?
I grew up on Burncoat Hill.
Burncoat Hill.
Yep. And
you go on the mic.
Oh, okay. All right.
Couple of things. When I was going to school.
Here we go.
When I was going to school, we used to listen to the radio before we went to school, and there was the Flint, Michigan one that day, and when I got home, we were right in the midst of the tornado. So, that's...
Wow. And do you remember the hail?
Yes. The hail, and... after the tornado was over, I was working at the Girl Scout camp, so I went off, and we couldn't live in the house, so we had to wait, and with, somebody else, we were with people that were living in another house, because we couldn't live in our house, because Burncoat. And another thing was, when we used to listen to the radio in the morning to get news, and we had the tornado news at that time. So I didn't live there. I was working at the Girl Scout camp, so I just went out to the Girl Scout camp, and my mother and sister went to live with somebody in Auburn. So.
Nice story.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I was here at WBI then, and I was a young faculty member. It was our last faculty meeting of the year. Classes were out, the students had left, and graduation was still coming up. I remember we had the faculty meeting in Boynton, and there were stories about severe thunderstorms coming. And they joked about those sitting near the window. Little did we know what was coming. But we were not affected here, as just pointed out, it was all north of here. After the meeting, as some of us like to do, we went up to the old coach and six for a beer. And while we were there, we thought the enormous freight trains were going by on the B&M tracks, which ran right next to them. And the lights went up. And so we finished the beer and went out. Holy God. There was mud everywhere. Cars were covered in mud, but they were still okay. But we could see piles of cars up to the north. So we got down and drove back through the mud, people racing around, and up, it was a wild scene. We parked here and found a piecemeal. What happened here was the Sanford Rug, classes have been out. saw the building was empty. That was turned into a provisional hospital for non-critical cases. The critical cases were sent to the hospitals. And all through the night, there were ambulances. That's all you could hear. They came from Springfield, Providence, all the towns in between, as did doctors. The neighbors brought in blankets and sheets. We put around Sanford Island was just jammed with outside ambulances, police cars bringing in people, and private cars bringing in people. And so that was the scene here. And I worked with Professor Newell that night. We had station WYK, our amateur student broadcasting station. And we were on an amateur network, which he had set up. And we took calls from relatives and transmitted and so forth. But the next week, this is one of the few communication places you can get through. Everything else was either emergency calls or you just wouldn't get through the northern part at all. So it was an amazing time. And I remember all night long, people were coming in ambulances, cars, and there were no students around, but all kinds of neighbors came and carried people in, and the people in the dormitory assigned people to rooms. And that's what it was like at WPI. And all through the summer, people lived in Sanford Riley so we could find other places. And that year, the graduation was held on the field. So that's what it was like at WPI the day of the tornado. It was a very unforgettable event.
Vivid recollection, sir. Thank you. Yes.
The day of the storm, I worked at the Norton Company on New Bond Street in the Research and Development Department, and we got out of work at 5 o'clock. And it was imminent that was a storm coming, but I headed south and got home, and on the 6 o'clock news, they announced that Worcester or Northern Worcester had been struck by a tornado, and particularly the Assumption College area. And I had a friend, my best friend, worked at a bottling company on the corner of West Boylston Street and Marlin Road, which is immediately to the left of the Assumption College campus. And so I got in my car and I drove back and abandoned it just about at New Bond Street because they weren't allowing traffic to go further north, and it was impassable anyway. But anyway, I walked several blocks up West Boylston Street and went into the bottling company and found my friend there. He was alive and well, and he had lived through the whole storm and escaped the consequences, yet it went directly over his building. My brother-in-law, who was a student at Assumption Prep, was called upon the next day to help clean up the area in and around Assumption, and he can remember finding dollar bills or money bills all over the ground scattered, and that he picked up and returned. And as another part of it, my boss at Norton Company in the Research and Development Department lived on Randall Street, which was immediately to the right of Assumption. And he went out of his house and found that the four tires on his car were completely flat. And he remarked how strange it was to see that happen. And I can remember that for maybe several months thereafter, his home was devastated, and the Norton Company threw open a empty warehouse on Bond Street, where he was allowed to store his furniture for possibly 6 months till he got another place to live.
Great story, sir. Yes, yes, sir.
I think this is the book that probably you've seen.
Yes.
It's a book that I'm welcome to share with you. This is in Holden, and right here at the corner, it was the Elanda family that went to school with my wife and myself. And he heard the noise, looked out the window, saw the barn in the house of the Oslin family explode. He grabbed his family, and they jumped behind the couch right here. And they ended up in the backyard, and the rug rolled over them, and the rug carried them into the backyard. They didn't get hurt. And there was nothing left, as you can see. The family across the street, the Oslin family barn house, that was the house you had a picture of the baby being carried away. They didn't find that for about three days later. That was the Oslin family. We knew Nancy Oslin real well. It was her sister that was running from the house back to her house, and she got severely hurt. The baby was lost, and when the Oslin girl was arrived at the Holden Hospital, a good friend of hers didn't recognize her because she had so much blood packed up. I'm welcome to share this with you later.
I'm a man of science, but I'm also a man of faith, and that, sir, is the unseen hand there protecting those people. I'm saying those people caught a break. It's called Providence, where they got rolled up in a carpet and rolled to safety.
Well, the woman next door, right here, the next door, she was in the shower. And when it was all over, she's standing still with the water running out of the ground. And she didn't have any idea what happened. And she only had a minor cut, but the house was gone. And he grabbed some towels and clothing and put around her because she was totally mystified what happened.
Yes.
But we used to,
we used to get the radio for the listen to the radio in the morning before I went to school, and it was Flint, Michigan, I think that was the one.
That's correct. Yes.
And we used to get the weather forecast and things, and I said, well, it doesn't happen here.
You actually said that.
I did, because they used to want us to listen to the weather forecast.
Sure, because it was moving west to east, especially in the summer. Yes, sir. Raise your hand. Who saw the funnel cloud? Anybody? Amazing. I always ask that question. Nobody saw the funnel. Yes, sir.
I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I worked for Arthur D. Little. Two things. At Cambridge, at Arthur D. Little, a guy named Dr. Bernard Vonnegut was studying tornadoes before this happened, and he had a guy named Charlie Moore with him. Charlie Moore was famous for going up in a balloon into a thunderhead to about 80,000 feet. But Vonnegut's theory, which I haven't seen referenced since, was that tornadoes were caused by lightning inside them. He said there was a continuous issuance of lightning inside the tornado. But in connection with that, after the tornadoes had passed, you could look out over Boston Harbor and see the clouds maybe 5-10 miles away, and there was continuous lightning going on for several hours. It was fantastic to watch.
Nice story.
Thank you,
sir. Yes.
Just two quick follow-ups on Assumption College. When the hurricane hit, there was one central building very badly damaged. Two of the janitors thought they would be killed, so they get into the boiler, which was off being summer, closed the door. The whole building came down around. They didn't find them for 3 days.
Oh.
And they were in a panic because they were afraid the building was going to catch fire. Another case at Assumption. The National Guard were patrolling around, and they saw these two monks loading typewriters into a pickup truck and speaking to each other in language monks don't usually use. So they went over to the monks, you know, with a monk's outfit, and wanted to know what they were doing there. And they quickly determined they weren't monks. They were hoodlums from Providence. And they found the monks' clothes lying around. They put them on, started loading, trying to hide them. That's another lighter side.
Yes, sir.
I was living in Newton Corner at the time, and I had gone over the wall there to visit with my classmate, Ken Stewart. And the thing I remember about that is that we went out to it because there was this lightning display that we had never seen anything like it before. The whole sky lit up. There were no individual lightning bolts that you could discern. It was the whole sky that lit up, and I never seen anything like that since.
Yes, sir.
My mother lived in Brentwood, and one-story house. And there was a garage on one end, the right end side of the house had a garage. Next to that was a family room. These were on a slab. And then you stepped up a couple of steps and the rest of the house was on wood floors. And it was built on a fieldstone foundation. It wasn't a full cellar, but a crawl space. When the tornado came, the house rotated about like it was, the end that was on the fieldstone foundation stayed pretty much in place. And the garage and the family room went into the backyard. The car in the garage, the only thing left on the floor of the garage was the rear wheels of the car. So the whole house twisted, and the car is out in the backyard except for the rear wheels that were still on the garage floor. The whole roof was twisted. The house was condemned and torn down. The strange thing about it was the living room had a picture window looking out into the backyard. And there was a drapes that covered the window. When the storm came, it lifted the roof up. It sucked the curtains outside, and the roof came back down. So after the tornado was gone, there was the curtain hanging outside, and still on the Travis Rod inside. My mother and my kid brother were in the house at the time it happened. My father had died a few months earlier. And they sat in they were in a little bathroom that was kind of in the front of the house, and they weren't damaged at all. They weren't hurt at all. The water line that came to the house was just, the house had been ripped off from it. The water was squirting out this half-inch pipeline or one-inch pipeline. Some guy with an axe came by and banged on it and closed it off so the water wouldn't keep running anymore. But they both came out fine. My mother had nothing to worry about but what she was going to do with all her furniture, so it kind of took her mind off her losing her husband, which is a godsend.
Yes, sir.
Just to add to what Frank said, I wasn't in the tornado, but after the tornado, I was graduated from high school and got a job working in construction. And basically, we worked that whole summer just repairing damaged houses. We didn't rebuild any from ground up, so these were houses damaged, and we had a large Victorian house in Rutland, the center of Rutland, and that house had been rotated on its foundation about a foot rotated, but the house was still square and sound. The entire second floor was gone. You walked up the stairs to the second floor, here's the hardwood floors, you can see where all the partitions had been. But the whole second floor was gone, but the first floor was intact, and it had been rotated about a foot on the foundation. So apparently this was a common thing, where the rotating winds would move the houses around. One additional thing about that house, it had a huge wraparound porch, as Victorian houses did, and the top carrying beam on the porch was about a 6x12 pine or spruce plank beam. And the boss went guy. We got some other flunkies, and we had to wrestle that thing out of the woods and over snowballs and so forth to get it back up there. But the damage was just unbelievable. And my father actually worked at Martin Company. He was foreman of the carpenter masonry department. And I remember getting a call at home telling him to get back into work. And we didn't see him for days because there was so much damage that he was just working 24 hours a day. I think it was probably about 5 days before he went back home again. But just indescribable for any of you who saw the aftermath of that. It really looked like a bomb.
I'm sure it has a lot of engineers here scratching their heads to see what these cyclonic winds do to structures. A couple more and then we'll break. Yes, sir.
I live in Rutland, and I did then, and I worked for the Barrow Combing. And when the storm was coming from my house, I could see what looked like just leaves or something in the air and the black cloud. I had to errand to do, and I thought, well, I better put my chainsaw in the trunk in case there's a limb across the road or something. So I drove into the center of town and saw what had actually happened, and so I thought, well, maybe I can help with my chainsaw, and I didn't have much of any gas. I went to the gas station, can I get some gas? He says, well, I think I got a hand crank here somewhere, and maybe I can pump some gas up by converting to the hand crank because there's no electricity. And so he did, and he filled up my gas can, and I ended up working for a week with the town DPW because they didn't even have a chainsaw. One of the trees that sticks in my mind was about, oh, at least 3 feet in diameter, an oak tree, and it had been twisted and broken, and well, it had a stump maybe eye level high, but it had just twisted around until it broke off that tree.
Think of all the people that you helped because something told you at that very moment to throw the chainsaw in the car, and think of all the people you lessened their misery because of that. Bless you. Anybody else?
There was one more thing.
Yes, sir.
The fellow that died in Rutland was a school principal. His name was Don Marsh, and his wife was injured, and their baby was pushed out of the mother's hand and ended up skewered on a limb of an apple tree. But she lived, and they cut off the limb and took it to the Veterans Hospital, limb and person, and they were able to safely remove the limb, and she's still alive. Others were injured, one family and friends. They went to their cellar. The cellar was made of cement blocks instead of poured concrete, and as the house took off, those blocks became shrapnel, and they both were very severely injured, but they lived too. It's something nobody will forget.
Yes, sir.
I only have an anticlimactic footnote to what Professor Grogan had said. My only distinction is I was in the class of 53. That graduated, and I was home in Connecticut when the tornado hit. So all I remember is graduation was supposed to be in the Worcester Auditorium down in Lincoln Square, but it was turned into a hospital or sanctuary or something after Riley. And so we had our graduation out on the football field.
One last one?
Can I just ask you, think that I heard this somewhere, that it never lifted off the ground from the time it sat out in Rutland and ended up in South.
That's my understanding. She said that it did not skip. Some tornadoes are known to skip, but that it stayed on the ground, and until it finally lifted up,
right,
passing through Worcester. One last, yes, sir.
You didn't mention anything about the pressure inside the tornado. It is very low, and that's what caused the guy's chest to burst open, and it's probably a major cause of death.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the cellar, and you're a lot better off than being close to where the base of it is.
That's correct. And then this myth of opening your windows in your house, you're supposed to go to a low, centralized area in the center of the house, closed off area. That's what gives you the most protection. But they don't have any accurate measurements inside the funnel, obviously, but it was extraordinary, a little low air pressure. When the man whose chest exploded, of course, you suffocate. You can't breathe with that type of air pressure. And the story about the car being lifted off and leaving the two wheels in the garage, that just shows you the extraordinary strength and the quickness of a storm. Snap of the fingers. Yes, sir, last story.
I better use the mic. My voice doesn't carry it. I lived on Woods Avenue off of Holden Street, close to Rutland. We were about two streets away from where it went through and crossed Holden Street and took down a number of houses. And my mother and I were there, and we went to the cellar. We heard this, it sounded like a freight train coming. We said, we better get in the cellar. So we got down there, and after it was over, I walked down to the end of Woods Avenue, and all these cars were coming by, and people were in them. And a friend of mine had a house where it was moved off of its foundation, and his mother and five kids were in the basement. And he came by in the car and said, would you go up and get my mother and kids and help them? I said, sure. So we did, and they stayed overnight, and everything came out all right. But the little thing about it was that about 10 years later, I was painting the side of my house, and I was up high on the second floor, and all of a sudden I came across this fork was stuck right in the house, and I figured that must have been from the tornado.
Well, thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure speaking here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. We have a couple of mementos here to remember Tech by.
Oh, wow.
We'd ask that you please put the hat on when you go down Memorial Drive in Cambridge.
Will do, and in fact, I'll wear it in Harvard Square when I go in next week, and absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Tech Old Timers. Thank you. God bless.